I first have to begin with an admission. Before that, I should say introduce myself. I'm Nader Vasugian. I'm a lecturer here at the Museum of Modern Art, but I'm also I also teach history and theory of architecture nearby at New York Institute of Technology. I should begin with an admission. This is not really a user's guide to the architecture of the Beijing Olympics. There's a lot we're not going to cover, and certainly, I think that the time frame that we've been afforded today doesn't permit an encyclopedic overview of things happening in Beijing. But I do hope to talk about some of the salient projects that are being built in Beijing today in anticipation of the Olympics, but also in Beijing more broadly, because I think that the Beijing Olympics, of course, is not just about the Olympics. It's not just about building stadia and sporting facilities to accommodate international athletes. It's also an opportunity, as we all know, for cities to present themselves anew to the rest of the world. And this is a long-standing tradition, and probably a culminating sort of turning point was the 92 Olympics in Barcelona. The 92 Olympics in Barcelona is always looked to, I think, by subsequent Olympic hosts, summer Olympic hosts, as an example, not just of how to reinvigorate urban infrastructure through Olympic complex design, but also how to really rethink your city more broadly through an opportunity like the Olympics. And certainly, if you visit Barcelona today, you can probably appreciate a bit of what I mean. I mean, it was certainly a great way that a country like Spain was able to come out from under the shadow of Franco and really kind of define itself or redefine itself as a sort of leading kind of 21st century or late 20th century city in Europe, particularly in the light of the foundation of the EU and European integration. And it certainly, I think, its reputation is certainly warranted. In many respects, the planners of the Beijing Olympics have attempted to do the same as Barcelona and then some. One of the questions I think that I want to ask you all and that I think is really worth thinking about for the months to come is Beijing a 21st century city? In the way that we are often told it is going to be, or is becoming, or is in the process of becoming, or is in fact sort of the last of the great 20th century cities. And maybe I'll clarify over the course of this lecture what precisely I mean by that question, but it's certainly something to think about. China, as we know, is really at the heart or at the crux of a great number of global developments happening in the world today. It's a city, as we know, of over 1.3 billion in population. It's the most populated nation state in the world, followed closely by India. Coupled with this enormous population is another sort of political development that we've sort of all heard a great deal about. And it has to do with the sort of slackening of the centralized planning principles and a slackening of sort of socialist principles and a kind of growing openness toward laissez-faire capitalism, right? And in fact, China over the last 15 years has really taken aggressively to the sort of kind of neoliberal model in an effort to galvanize its economy. So this image, I think, is a particularly revealing one because while it does show us an image of Mao, at the same time, it's a blurry image and one we can hardly recognize. Similarly, China still has the Communist Party is still really the state party in China, but largely in name. As a result of its kind of the liberalization of its economic policies, one of the things that's happened in China is, of course, that it's become the factory to the world. As this, as a recent article from the National Geographic just pointed out, and it's actually a gorgeous issue of the National Geographic, and I encourage you all to go out and grab it. The percent of the world's umbrellas made in China, it says, 70. Percent of the world's buttons made in China, 60. Percentage of U.S. shoes made in China, 72. Right? So chances are, of the articles we're all wearing in this room, a very high percentage of them had their genesis somewhere in China. So in a sense, what's happening in China is a statement, of course, about a country, but I think it's also a statement about the state of the world in a broader sense. One of the things that's happened as a result of this the rapid industrialization of its economic infrastructure is, of course, that it's become a haven for factories and of course, given rise to a class of factory workers and manufacturing industry workers who simply didn't exist up to 20 years ago. Of course, we've seen the resonance of that in the U.S. As a result of the growth of its industrial sector, we also see the growth of its automobile industry. China is, or Beijing alone, is adding 1,200 cars annually. It says that the number of privately owned cars in China is 11.5 million. And that actually sounds like a low number to me, given the size of its population, but we can probably bet that this number will grow dramatically in the months and years to come. Now, its construction, the pace of construction in China is also staggering, and that's borne out in cities like Shanghai, as you can see in this image. In 2005 alone, the New York Times reported that there were more tall buildings in construction in Shanghai at the time than there were tall office buildings, both residential and commercial, in total in New York City. So the pace of construction in Shanghai is really quite unbelievable. And most urban planners are forecasting a kind of dramatic a continued urbanization through 2030, such that probably as much as 35 or 40% of the entire national population will exist or be living in cities in China by the year 2030, at least according to an exhibition downtown at the Center for Architecture. Of course, as you probably know as well as I, China, as a result of this pace of development, is one of the world's, or is the world's leading consumer of raw materials. It produces nearly a third of the world's steel, and it probably consumes at least that amount. And the numbers in regards to things like cement, for instance, are equally high and quite eye-opening. Now, Beijing is an incredible case study, or offers us an incredible opportunity to study some of the broader issues, social, economic, political, facing China today. As you all know, it's playing host to the Olympics this summer. It's a capital city. It's located in the north of China. And it's surrounded by mountains, mountain ranges, both to the west and to the north. It's one of the few major cities in China today that doesn't actually have a major river passing through that. And in part, I think it's probably because when it was originally settled, it was mainly the planners were concerned with defensive issues. How can we protect our capital city? Rather than economic issues, how do we make ourselves grow? And like many capital cities, it's a city that, in a sense, always had a center. The Ming Dynasty built the Forbidden City that you see in the center of that. And the Forbidden City is a city that is defined by two axes, a north-south axis and an east-west one. And in as much as possible, the city has attempted to maintain the integrity of those two original axes. Now, this image is a little bit of a distortion, as someone pointed out in the last time I presented this lecture, in part because it doesn't really communicate the scale of Beijing today. Beijing is a city with a population of over 17 million, right? And that's its full-time day and night population. As we know in New York, that number fluctuates dramatically. Whether you ask someone what the population is during work hours and what it is at nighttime. What are the numbers now for New York City? What's our population here? Is it 7 million or is it 8 million? Is it 8 million already?
13.
Sorry?
8.2, I think, and 13 during
business day. Okay. So it's an enormous city. And of course, the Forbidden City, as I pointed out, is really the at the heart of it, at least historically. This is a view of the entrance looking north. This is a view of the Forbidden City from along Tiananmen Square. Now, around the Forbidden City are a series of rings. And you can see those here. I believe now today there are about 5 rings. They're vehicular rings. And again, both the axes and the rings themselves constantly try and reinforce the importance and the centrality of the Forbidden City in public life, which interestingly raises a funny paradox that as much as China wants to see itself as a kind of or particularly Beijing wants to see itself as an economic powerhouse, as a city dedicated to capitalism, it still wants to see itself as a political city, as the political heart of the country, as exemplified by the fact that the Forbidden City is really still the orientation point. And you can see that in this subway. In the subway diagram as well, there's a very clear east-west and north-south orientation. Now, two things I failed to point out. One is that the Olympic complex that we're going to spend a little bit of time on in just a bit is located to the north of the city. So it really flanks the north-south axis. And that axis is actually relatively new as well. It was designed by Albert Speer architects. Many of you like turn your heads, right, in surprise. Yes, Albert Speer is the son of the notorious Albert Speer, who was head of munitions under Adolf Hitler during World War II. In fact, in the press reception, many have drawn a comparison between the elder Speer's a proposal for the city of Berlin and the younger son's proposal for Beijing. Why is that? Well, like the father's proposal, this is a very monumental axis that extends 5 miles from the northern part of the city, reaches of the city to the south to a southernmost train station, right? And some have suggested that this is something that seeks to serve the perhaps latent imperial ambitions of the state. This is the again, the subway grid. Now, to the northeast of the city is a newly completed airport by Sir Norman Foster of England. And this is really the first kind of complex that we're going to look at today. In many respects, it's really difficult to comment on from a design perspective or from a purely architectural point of view, because a lot of the kind of concerns that define this design are technical in nature. How big are airplanes? How much space do they need? How are bigger airplanes going to be in the next 20 years? How many passengers will exit those airplanes? It's those kind of very nitty-gritty technical concerns that I think did a great deal as far as defining the overall layout of this thing. The complex itself, just to give you a sense of its scale, is enormous. It is reputed today to be the largest building in the world. It is a complex that could house all four terminals of Heathrow under one roof. And this is just one terminal in the Beijing airport. It's Terminal 3. At its greatest width, this is about a half a mile long, or so I've read. I haven't actually visited it myself. It is projected that by 2015, there will be about 50 million visitors annually that pass into the country through this depot. Now, in a sense, this is the gates. These are the new gates of Beijing. And we all know that in capital cities throughout history, the entranceway was always of great significance, right? Whether you go to visit Rome, or whether you're in a city, or even in ancient Egypt, how you entered into the city was important, right? And in a sense, I think that many of the things that ancient planners attempt to accomplish through their entrances, I think Norman Foster wanted to do as well. Namely, he wanted to impress the visitor, right? Because this is a capital city. And certainly, I think the scale speaks to that. It's not just a capital city, though. It's a global capital city, or at least it'd like to see itself that way. And I think that's why they concentrated on building such a magnificent, or rather large-scale airport, rather than, for instance, a train station, which might have a more regional orientation. Now, one of the inspirations for the form, at least according to Norman Foster, is the dragon, which of course has a kind of national resonance in the Chinese imagination. And some have cited these light apertures on the roof as sort of part of the dragon's, those things on its back. Scales. Thank you very much. Thank you. The individual walkways are all kind of color-coded in order to orient the spectator. Of course, there are these enormous kind of concourses that almost sort of inspire a sense of the sublime, something that you can imagine but not quite grasp, because there's a sort of overwhelming feel that the scale of this thing projects. And I think it was in part not only to accommodate the throngs of people that pass through the space, but also in order to inspire in one a sense of the kind of certain magnitude and perhaps importance of this site. This is or self-importance maybe. This is the, I believe, a departures concourse that faces this area over here for pickup and drop-off spaces. And you can see this is mostly domestic flights on this side and international on the other side, but that's not so important. The airport is just up there, if we had enough of the map to show you. So now that we're in the city, so to speak, we can look at what's in the city. And I'm going to show you a number of different kind of building programs that are either currently underway or have recently been finished. Now, the first of those is a housing complex. And that's, again, just over here. Excuse me. Over here, there's the Forbidden City again, just to orient you as to where the center is. It's a complex of eight buildings with about 750 apartments designed by Stephen Hall. Now, there are a number of sort of salient features to this thing. And not only is it a residential apartment building, but it's also fashioned as a commercial and cultural area, as well as a recreational facility. So, you know, when I saw Stephen Hall on Charlie Rose not too long ago, he really described this complex as a city within a city. And you can sort of appreciate what he means by that. It's inward looking, it's self-sufficient, it provides for one's, or attempts to provide for one's daily amenities. Now, one of the reasons for that, according to Stephen Hall, is to do with this image. It's an image of traffic, and it's an image of congestion. And we all know that there's tremendous congestion and also pollution in Beijing today. And one of the things that Stephen Hall wanted to attend to was to create a complex that could, in some very small way, alleviate congestion by providing for people's needs on a very localized basis, right? That You can shop, eat, have fun, and sleep all within walking distance of where you live. That's a good question. Affordable to whom? But maybe that's an important question, and I think it's a bigger question that we could apply to a lot of the things we're going to look at. So maybe we'll bracket that until the till the end. But it's a really important one. This was a kind of schematic diagram that I came across on Stephen Hall's website, and it illustrates one of the concepts for the design. What does this say? It says urban space, how the city was, right? The horizontal city, how the city perhaps is, the vertical city, and how it should be, right? So he wants to kind of reconcile the intimacy of perhaps the pre-industrial Beijing with the density afforded by the kind of Beijing as metropolis. And he seeks to integrate those through this design that he's proposed. Of course, one of the most salient features of it being these sky bridges that span between the buildings. Stephen Hall, like many of the architects, was allowed in a tremendous amount of license as far as where things went and how much he could budget for a given intervention. So he was able to sort of add some nifty details, like, for instance, installing a pool inside the bridge that you can see here, suspended in the sky between two buildings. Now, I think one of the statements that he wants to make there is not only to kind of create a pool that, you know, offers magnificent views, as well as perhaps to shock us a bit, but also I think it's a statement about how he conceptualized the program or the site itself. Namely, this is not a single-use complex as it was originally intended by the developers. It's a mixed-use complex, which is to say that it sort of brings together a whole host of different activities and programs in an effort to deal with some of the perhaps environmental and quality of life issues that the city is currently coping with today. It also has, again, this network of elevated parkscapes that span between the buildings, right? So another quality of life measure.
Is this connected to the Olympics?
No. Well, it is. And as I mentioned before, the Olympics isn't just about athletics. In the end, I think that this is a project that is about the Olympics in as much as it's about the city of Beijing. And I think through the Olympics, China doesn't just want to provide great facilities on a short-term basis for athletes. It wants to kind of redefine itself in the eyes of the rest of the world. And projects like these are an opportunity to do so. And which also accounts in part for why particularly European and American architects have played such an aggressive role in these designs. Stephen Hall is a world-renowned architect, as well as being incredibly talented. And for that reason, I think that from a developer standpoint, it allows one a certain measure of exposure that one wouldn't otherwise afford, on the global scale at least. Yeah.
Actually constructed.
Yeah. This is a rendering, so it is under construction right now. This is where the project stands. Again, a kind of world within a world. I think that the best thing to do at this point, just given the amount of time we have, if we just kind of save our questions, please write them down. I don't mean to. This is a view of the sky bridges spanning between the buildings. Again, a vision of a city within a city. The second project we're going to look at is in the newly established central business district of Beijing. Again, Beijing is a city that is kind of wants to see itself as a capital city, but also as a city of capitalism. And one of the anchor pieces in that new kind of expression of capitalism is the CCTV complex, which you can see right over here, and I'm going to talk about in just a minute. It's located in east of to the east of the city, and it was really conceptualized as a sort of catalyst, as a sort of economic catalyst for the area. And already, according to one of the project's designers, Ollie Sharon, who works in collaboration with the Office for Metropolitan Architecture and Rem Koolhaas, who are the architects of note on this project, in anticipation of the completion of this project, which is supposed to be done in time for the Olympics, real estate values have already soared. And in fact, many of the buildings that surround the CCTV complex that are already completed were only begun and initiated after OMA's proposal was submitted, accepted, and approved. As you all know, many of you perhaps, MoMA sponsored a show on the CCTV TVCC complex by Ollie Sharon and Rem Koolhaas. And it was a really great exhibit because it, for me anyway, because it kind of walked you through some of the deliberations formally and socially that informed the design of this project. It consists, it's basically this kind of cranked vertical loop. It's, again, I think like the Norman Foster complex, an enormous undertaking in terms of size and scale. It's, I believe, from the base to the top about 50 stories. The amount of office space that it accommodates is just under that of the World Trade Towers combined. Right? I believe it's something in the order of 5 million square feet of office space. So it's a really enormous and gargantuan undertaking, but not just because of its size, but also because of its structure. You know, a lot of people ask, you know, how do you get this thing to suspended in the sky hundreds of feet above Beijing, particularly given the extent to which the city is often, I mean, it sits close to a fault line where there are frequent earthquakes. So that was really one of the first big issues that the designers had to address. Now, in partnership with Arup, a London-based engineering firm who's actually played a huge role in all the complex I'm going to show you, they came up with a solution that involved using a diagrid structure. Now, a diagrid structure is different from a steel frame structure in that the structure is actually, the structural loads are actually borne on the outside of the building rather than on the inside. And one of the rationales behind that is that it actually saves materials. Now, in this case, it doesn't save materials. In the case of another building that uses a diagrid system, like the Hearst Tower, the new Hearst Tower by Norman Foster over by Columbus Circle, it does, right? In fact, that building apparently saves about 50% of steel that it would otherwise use if it were a regular steel frame. At least aesthetically, the one of the things the designers wanted to do was to illustrate or show visually where the loads were strongest and where the concentration of structure was strongest through its skin, right? Through this diagrid that you see in the image. Behind the CCTV is TVCC, which hosts a combination of sort of hotel-related programs, as well as a cultural center and a kind of auditorium space. This is the plan of the complex itself, CCTV, TVCC across the street, and a service building nearby. One of the salient features of this design that the architects often point out is that it's not just intended for use by CCTV, which is the Chinese state television. It's also meant to be accessible to the public. It has a broadcasting or studio spaces in the base of the building and various production and administrative offices throughout. Now, a second feature in regards to the layout, the programmatic layout of the building that's significant, is the fact that all of the activities related to television production for CCTV are housed in this one single building rather than being strewn throughout the city. So in a sense, it's also a kind of city within a city in a funny way as well. Here's a circulation diagram that can shows where the public loop and the loop of for the staff, right? A staff loop and a public loop. Now, I think this intervention is a controversial one. As many of you know, CCTV is a television outlet that's been kind of roundly criticized for being a kind of arm of state policy. In many ways, it has been. And in some ways, the architecture of the building serves to counter those perceptions by making provisions for a public loop. But as we all know, in buildings, you see what people want you to see. So, the degree to which this building actually affords the visitor the transparency that he or she might actually desire is actually somewhat contestable, which I think raises other interesting questions about the relationship between architecture and politics in the world today. This is a kind of view of the elevations of the building laid out with an illustration of where the structural loads are most significant or most concentrated. This is a view of the TVCC tower, which I think was conceptualized as a kind of series of uniform cells plugged into a sort of passive envelope. And I think the commentary here has a lot to do with remarks that Rem Koolhaas made about the generic character of the modern skyscraper in his incredible book, Delirious New York, which you should all grab a copy of if you haven't read it. I love teaching it every semester. It's a really fun book about New York. Again, ARUP is an structural engineering firm that worked with OMA on this project. In terms of its construction, the construction process was a big part of how the design was both conceptualized and engineered. In other words, they had to figure out a way to make these two towers stand up on their own before they actually met at their apex point, because they're actually angled. And one of the interesting details is that the corner where the two cantilevers met, it was actually a quite difficult task. They had to have these two corners, the two kind of halves of the loop, so to speak, meet at a very specific time in very specific climactic conditions, given the ways in which steel expands and contracts. So while this is an unbelievably large-scale undertaking, the attention to detail that was required is quite staggering. This is the loop as it stands today. The hope is that the building, at least its facade, will be completed in time for the Olympics, which is to say that it won't be inhabitable just yet, but it will be there for the eyes of the global media to see. And the role that the global media is to play in this project and in the architecture and the representation of the architecture is not to be underestimated, as we'll talk about in just a minute. Again, the Olympic complex itself is to the north of the city. Again, it runs along this north-south axis that I talked to you earlier. It was basically the site planners for the Olympic complex itself wanted to avoid the mistakes that were made in Sydney. In Sydney, Australia, the Olympic hosts of that and planners, a mistake they made was that they made the complex too far from the city, and they didn't actually figure out how to make the complex viable after the life of the Olympics. And so one of the things that they insisted on here was making provisions for housing and also commerce so that the area could sustain itself well after the Olympics. And I'll describe that in just a minute. Sorry. The two anchor pieces of this site are the pool, the pool complex by ST or PTW Architects, and the Olympic National Olympic Stadium by Herzog and Demiron. And they flank again the major north-south axis, and this is a view I believe it's a north-facing view. South-facing, excuse me. Thank you very much. South-facing. Why do I show this image? This is the Guggenheim Museum in Bilbao, Spain. I just want to show it for a second. The iconic character of both buildings at the Beijing Olympic site was of paramount significance. They wanted to make objects that resonated with people visually, not just on site, but also through the media. And certainly this formula of buildings, iconic buildings, as a means of, let's say, galvanizing a city, in the case of Bilbao, Spain, is a kind of a strategy of urban intervention that people like Frank Gehry pioneered in the early 1990s, and which I think Beijing as a city wanted to build upon and draw from in their own thinking about the role of architecture in that city. And this is something that Charles Jenks, a longtime kind of advocate and proponent of postmodernism, talks about in his book, The Iconic Building. And this is the Gherkin in London by Norman Foster. These are, again, you can see the pool facility over here, the National Olympic Stadium to the right, and surrounding it a combination of all kinds of programs that are recreational, commercial, and residential in nature, as well as park spaces, in order to attend to both the short-term uses of the site, but also its long-term needs. Second angle view of the same. Now, these are, in many respects, two buildings that couldn't be more dissimilar, and yet they complement each other. And they're separated by this axis. One is round, the other one is square. One has this funny kind of like zigzaggy shape, and the other one is sort of made up of these little bubbles. And at least metaphorically, the idea was to play with this motif of yin and yang. But I think also in order to allow the buildings to play off each other formally so that they can almost serve as their own sovereign arc icons, which then reinforce the main axis that separates them. The first building we're going to look at, this Herzog and Demiron complex, is consists of this giant steel frame. I mean, it kind of looks chaotic and anarchic in character, but in fact, there are these. It's a very porous structure, and it consists of these 24 kind of lattices that are then layered with a secondary structure that affords an added degree of rigidity, and also serves the building aesthetically. Many people have compared this form to a bird's nest. It's something that reporters and different people have commented on. And this was the structure as it stood just a few months ago. It's a view from through the interior spaces. This is a view of the thing under construction. As anarchic as it looks, there is a method to its madness, and there is actually a kind of, I think, a there were a couple of I can't remember the word. I'm going to forget it. I stumbled. That's okay. View of the interior. The second building, I think, which was represented a partnership project between both Arup, who also worked on the National Olympic Stadium, as well as CCTV and so forth, is this pool complex. And in my mind, and the pool complex is actually the most resolved design architecturally on the site. Whereas there's this kind of, I think, awkward distinction between the primary and secondary structure in the National Olympic Stadium, which is formally really cute, but in some ways over-designed. It actually has often been criticized in the press for you know, using an unbelievable amount of steel, like 41,000 tons of steel it was built with, or something like that. This, I think, was a building that was really well conceptualized and executed from both a structural as well as aesthetic and programmatic point of view. The model was that to really think of this as a sort of system of bubbles, right, which I guess makes sense, which given that it has to do with accommodating activities related to water sports. Here's a plan of the complex. It has a number of indoor swimming pools as well as a seating complex that can house about 17,000 spectators. Now, the structural membrane, I think, is one of the most unique features of this complex. These are actually each of these consists of a sort of a steel section filled in with a plastic polymer. That's unique for a lot of reasons. This plastic polymer is self-cleaning. It's actually extraordinarily light. It's about 1%, has about 1% the weight of glass. The amount of light allowed that penetrates the space is actually can actually vary. They can actually you can sort of fill up the member or the space between. You can actually there's actually a cushion of air between the two levels of skin that you can inflate or deflate in order to allow different sunlight levels, and that's to allow natural sunlight when you need natural sunlight, but also to darken the space if, for instance, you're showing stuff on television and need to control the natural light conditions more effectively. This is a view from the one of the views from the indoor area here. The structural system, the steel frame that was used, apparently is actually quite strong, and so if the building were on its side, it would still stand, or at least according to some of the engineering literature that I've come across in my research. 4,000 bubbles made of steel members and spherical connectors, these things over here. And apparently, given the sophistication of some of the software technology we have today, you know, every small change, like adding a new door somewhere, has tremendous implications in terms of how the thing is composed structurally. And given the speed of our computers today, they were able to process these computations quite quickly, allowing designers to, in a sense, collaborate with engineers in ways that were impossible only a few years ago, it seems. This is the view of the site of the complex under construction with a view of the design by Herzog Demiron in the background. It's a view of the inside of the pool complex. Bigger issues to look out for in the months to come. One of the themes, I think, in this talk that I've been trying to highlight is the theme of sustainability. We've seen, particularly in the pool hall that we just saw, efforts to deal with issues of passive solar energy, natural light. We talked about ways of saving materials like steel. And yet, despite these, environmental measures, Beijing is still one of the most polluted cities in the world. And this is, it hasn't quite achieved the level of so-called, what are those days called? Blue sky days. In fact, the amount of the amount of pollution that one finds there on an ordinary day, or sometimes even on a good day, is still 10 times higher than that one will encounter in a city like LA, which we also consider polluted. This problem has led certain Olympic athletes to actually withdraw from participation, including this marathon runner. There are also development issues. The number of inhabitants displaced by the north-south axis by Albert Speer is ostensibly quite significant, or is, I'm told, very high in number. And so these kinds of social issues raised by the high sort of pace of construction is not something that one typically comes across, particularly when you sort of parse through the architectural literature. And then, of course, is the civil rights, civil liberties issues, as exemplified by the Tiananmen Square massacre of 1992. Of course, one can't help but to think of the Olympics as an opportunity or as a for a city like Beijing to try to reinvent its image in the wake of something like that. And then, of course, the human rights issues in countries like Tibet, as well as Darfur, that China has been implicated in, which raise other kinds of questions about that I think are germane not just to people as ordinary citizens, I think, but also to architects and to people that are on the ground, so to speak, designing and working on that site. And then, of course, the problem of migrant labor. About 50% of all construction in Beijing today is actually done with migrant workers, people from the countryside in Beijing. The reason migrant workers are used is because you can pay them less, and also they have fewer rights. In a city like Beijing, people who live there have to register with the city. If you're a migrant worker, you don't. And so it's much easier to take advantage of you. And that certainly happened, I think, to quite a significant extent. And actually, someone from MoMA pointed out to me that only recently the BBC reported that the Chinese government actually went out of its way to suppress the number of deaths that occurred as a result of the construction of the National Olympic Stadium. You know, which really makes one wonder again, is Beijing the last sort of city of the 20th century, or is it the first city of the 21st century? What I want to suggest, though, is that, you know, there has been a lot of negative media attention in regards to the Olympics in China, as well as positive stuff. But I think that in some respects, speaking for myself, maybe both of these issues are flawed because both of these perspectives are flawed. As I pointed out at the outset, we as consumers here in the U.S. Depend a great deal on China for our consumer needs. So I think what's happening in a city like Beijing today is inextricably connected to what's happening in the U.S. and in other parts of the world for that matter. So I think that when we think about issues of accountability and we think about some of the problems as well as exciting developments in China and Beijing today, I think we have to bear in mind that the problems and issues that this site and its architecture raise are both local, national, not both. They're local, they're national, and I think certainly they're also global. And that's why I end with this image of a kind of image of global capitalism.
What is that?
It's a photograph by Andreas Gursky. Of Stock Exchange, and I can't remember what city, maybe Chicago? Mercantile Exchange, I'm not sure. That's it. So I didn't mean to sort of, please ask your questions, is what I'm saying.
And the architect of the stadium?
Herzog and Demiron, they're a Basel-based architecture practice. Yes?
Sorry.
Yes.
And I wondered how close that was to the actual site and how close it is to those magnificent apartment complexes.
Oh, I don't know. I mean, how close the public transportation is? Yes, I mean, I think that the public transportation, you're saying how close to the Olympic complex? Well, the Central Business District runs along the east-west axis, and the Olympics runs along the north-south axis, the Olympic Village. So they're both... It's like very connected. Yes. Yes.
I was confused between renderings and actual buildings.
Yeah, I get confused all the time as well. Which was which? Yeah.
So in other words, you don't really know how far advanced they are by this time.
Well, no. I think in some cases, you know, I think I tried to give a, you know, I think that the when I showed photographs, I tried to show some construction sites, so you see the messiness. No, you know, it's there's some things like the swimming hall actually is finished. The Herzog Demiron National Olympic Stadium is finished. CCTV won't be finished, but they will have like the skin, the wrapping finished. So you'll still be able to see it on TV, which in some ways I think was the most important thing, at least where the construction process was concerned.
The uses that the sports uses will be completed.
Yes, and of course, all of this, I have to say, is ongoing. You know, I mean, there's so much development happening, and it doesn't, the pace hasn't appeared to have slackened over the last 3 years, contrary to what many people thought or anticipated.
Lots of problems.
Well, that's
what's on paper.
That's right. That's sort of what's often been suggested in the press lately. Yes?
Can't we all go on to Google Earth and watch the progress of the construction?
Oh, you know, Google Earth, most of those images are about a year outdated.
Oh, are they?
Yeah.
Ah.
So, yeah, just look. Try looking at your apartment and the scaffold that was there 2 years ago that's no longer there. You probably still find it. Yes? The architects of the pool were PTW Architects of Australia. The architect of the stadium was Hertog and Dameron. Now, in both cases, they collaborated with Arup, which is an engineering firm based in London. And Arup has played a major role in terms of like innovating a lot of the new structural systems that we're seeing in some interesting new buildings today, or at least. He's a urban planner. So he did like a big. He was charged with kind of doing the designing or the north south axis.
In other words, where to put the place.
Exactly, on a big scale, right? He didn't do actual buildings, to my knowledge. Yes.
Danny, what kind of a book I can look up your lecture today?
My lecture. Hopefully, this lecture won't appear as a book. I don't know. I'm on all honesty. I consider myself an amateur. I think on this subject particularly, my specialty is European modernism. But I believe I'm told that some of these, or my lecture and perhaps certain others, will be made available as little audio things you can download on the internet and listen to in the car on a long trip, if you have the patience. Yes. Delirious New York.
Oh, okay.
Fun book. Rem Koolhaas.
Okay.
Yes?
What kind of weather does the city have?
That's a really good question. Can someone speak to that? Because I can't answer that very well. I mean, I've never spent an extended period of time there before.
It's very cold. It's in the north. Uh-huh. It's very cold.
Uh-huh. But they have four seasons.
Yes.
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 Sunshine is very
okay. Sunshine is very strong. It's not very strong.
Pollution events.
Right.
Direct sunshine.
Yeah. Yes.
What percentage of the buildings, offices in the buildings, are rented or committed for rent? These are all private enterprises.
Are they all private enterprises? You know, I don't quite understand the how these things work administratively, like what's private, what's public, you know, who's working with whom. I honestly don't really understand it yet, you know, like because I know that, you know, the state still wields incredible power, but of course there also there's this class of developers there who have kind of achieved levels of wealth that could only dream, right? So I don't quite grasp it. In fact, you know, one of the interesting things I've read not so long ago is, you know, China went from being one of the most like equitable nations in the world after after Denmark, I believe, just not so long ago, to today being one of the most unequal countries in the world economically, even more so in the United States than the United States, and that's kind of hard to imagine, I think. I don't know if that answers, so I can't answer your question as well as I'd like to. Yes?
What's the plan for the afterlife? Or when?
Some of the parts of the complex are actually slated to be sold to private developers. And there's a park complex there and high-rise towers, residential towers. The whole point is to kind of plan something that can have an afterlife. Like today, Sydney is struggling to their Olympic complex is struggling to reinvent itself and to make it more viable, because it's hard to get people to even want to rent their venues because they're not as centrally located as they had hoped. And this is a more centrally located venue, which of course has positives and negatives, right? We saw that here with West Side Stadium and all the controversy around that. No one wants the stadium in their backyard, but in some ways in the world today, that's what people tell us brings revenue. At least that's what we're told. Was there a question? Yes? It's a funny story. OMA, the Office for Metropolitan Architecture. Rem Koolhaas started OMA in collaboration with three other people, I believe. But increasingly, particularly with this project, one of Rem Koolhaas' partners or principals, Olli Scheren, who's a very young German architect, he's like actually my age, has sort of taken the lead as far as in the design. And he's actually kind of the spokesperson for the building, which actually raises interesting questions for me as far as like whether there isn't a debate within OMA about how they feel about this project. Because it's already been highly criticized because of the political, the kind of nexus of political issues that whole thing raises. Is it, a kind of monument to a new kind of 21st century architecture, or is it just another example of state propaganda? That's one of the most overt issues that raises. But yes, sorry.
What's the name again?
Olli Scheren, OLLESCHEEREN. And Rem Koolhaas is the other guy. But of course, we like to attach individuals' names, but these are huge undertakings that involve lots of parties. And in some ways, when we just name one name, it's just a convenient shorthand way of talking about a whole network of relationships and attaching a star's name to it in order to make it more palatable to, regular people like me. Yes, and you. Is Zaha Hadid? I'm sure Zaha Hadid is building something there. I don't know. I mean, the phenomena of the global architect has become so kind of pervasive. And certainly of Zaha Hadid's generation, I think that if she's not building something in Beijing, I'm sure she's building lots of things elsewhere in China. But I can't really say for sure factually. I don't know enough.
Any Chinese architect to get involved?
That's a good question. Are any Chinese architects involved? Here's what my friends tell me.
Like pay.
Why isn't pay involved? I don't know. I mean, pay.
Well,
I think what's happening is that yes, there's been a huge backlash. People are saying, why are you just hiring American and European architects? And I think that now that this whole like boom of bringing in celebrity architects into China is I think it's still going on, but I think now there's another generation of Chinese architects that's also getting to take on huge commissions that only people like Herzog and Demiron used to get. And I think that's for a lot of reasons.